From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As the House moves closer to impeaching President Trump, members of the Senate today questioned the Justice Department Inspector General about the origins of the FBI's Russia probe. DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report found no evidence that the FBI's investigation of the Trump campaign was politically motivated. But he also told the Senate Judiciary Committee today that there were significant errors in the FBI's investigation.
Although we did not find documentary or testimonial evidence of intentional misconduct, we also did not receive satisfactory explanations for any of the errors or omissions we identified.
Meanwhile, the House Judiciary Committee is expected to convene at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight to begin finalizing the articles of impeachment before a vote of the full House, likely next week. Phil Ewing joins us now to discuss all of this. He's election security editor for NPR. And Phil, Horowitz looked into the FBI's investigation of that 2016 Trump campaign and possible ties with Russia. Republicans have highlighted that the FBI's serious performance failures, as detailed by Horowitz, what's been their line of questioning?
They want to drill down very closely on one specific part of the FBI investigation, the surveillance that officials conducted on a one-time junior foreign policy aide to Trump named Carter Page, who was the subject of a number of renewals by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court from 2016 and into 2017. And what Horowitz discovered was, as you mentioned, there were many problems with errors of fact and omission and practices by the FBI and the Justice Department in getting and then sustaining that surveillance. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, has drilled down very strongly on that as part of what's been a years-long effort by him and the president and their supporters to tear down federal law enforcement, the Justice Department and the FBI. In their view, the problems with that case are emblematic of wider problems with the FBI and the Justice Department, and that's been a leitmotif for some time.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Attorney General William Barr. He's attacked this report several times in the past couple of days. What impact do you believe his comments had on today's hearing?
Well, the ranking member, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, asked Horowitz, the inspector general, about those comments. And he said that he didn't have any undue influence from the attorney general before submitting this report. But he also restated that he believed there was an appropriate predication, as he said, for the FBI in 2016 to open the investigation into the Russian attack on the 2016 election. I mean, there really was an attack. There really was skullduggery that took place, which has been uncovered by investigators and has been the subject of so much focus since then. If Senator Graham focused on the details here about the Page story, the Carter Page story, Senator Feinstein and the Democrats want to talk about the big picture, that this really was an attack, that it really was Russia and not another nation has become the subject of controversy more recently here in Washington, and that the FBI and the Justice Department and other intelligence agencies were justified in responding to the information they were getting in 2016 and trying to figure out what was happening and then report about it to Congress and the American people as they have.
Yeah, you've mentioned the committee's ranking member, Senator Dianne Feinstein, and Democrats have focused on the conclusion that Horowitz found no evidence of political bias or improper motivation. Let's hear what she had to say.
I believe strongly that it's time to move on from the false claims of political bias. And those who showed great interest in the question of politically motivated investigations against President Trump should show the same concern about politically motivated investigations requested by the president or his attorney general.
Is this hearing today likely to bring any clarity to the ultimate point of this report? Are we just talking past each other, Republicans and Democrats?
The answer to your first question is no, among other reasons, because there are pages from the Horowitz report that are redacted. And so there are still things about the story about Carter Page, for example, that we do not know because they are continuing to be withheld by the government. The other question, which Senator Feinstein alluded to in those comments you played, is that there's another report about the investigation still pending from the Justice Department. Connecticut U.S. Attorney John Durham has been asked to do his own look at this. He's already said in an unusual statement when Horowitz is report came out that he disagrees with some of the things that are in that report. So we have a whole other chapter of litigating about this to look forward to whenever Durham's work is complete.
Okay, my last question with you for the few seconds that I have with you. The markup of the impeachment articles begin tonight. What are you watching for?
Well, that's going to be a normal process, but also very contentious. All legislation, whether it's naming post offices or impeaching the president, has to go through the same practice. So Democrats want it to be by the book, but we expect minority Republicans on the committee to make it as painful and draw it out as long as possible with procedural motions and other attempts to delay it.
That's Phil Ewing, election security editor for NPR. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Well, the UN Security Council meets today. The topic there, North Korea. The meeting comes at the request of the U.S. over concerns the North might escalate its missile tests, nuclear talks are stalled, and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sent an end-of-year deadline for American concessions, or the lifting of sanctions, to get them restarted. Last Saturday, North Korea announced it had conducted a test of, in its words, great significance. That action followed a series of missile launches. On Monday, Kim called President Trump heedless and an erratic old man after the president tweeted that Kim has too much to lose if he acts in a hostile way. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program in the studio with us. Jim, what are you hearing about what's going on?
Well, I was in Washington last week and had a chance to talk with current and retired U.S. officials, and I think they are of a view. While they keep hope alive, hoping that something else will happen, I think they have concluded that North Korea will, between now and sometime in early January, break the freeze-for-freeze agreement, engage in a provocation. The betting money, the inside money, is betting on a satellite launch, long-range satellite launch, as sort of an interim first move. A satellite, even though it would be for civilian purposes, would be carried up into space by something that looks very much like an ICBM or a long-range rocket. Not exactly, but close. And so that'll be interpreted negatively. So I think we're looking in the near term at a revival of the North Korean-U.S. nuclear crisis, or at least an opening gambit. And then they'll do that, and that's the overwhelming expectation. They'll do something big. And then the question is, what happens? Does that descend into crisis? Does that lead to a decision to have negotiations that lead to a good outcome? You know, there are pessimists and optimists who hold different views.
Well, I mean, and why would it lead to negotiations that lead to a good outcome? You know, I mean, that doesn't seem like it's – so we're left with potentially a crisis and potentially the U.S. reacting. What happened here? Because this was such a bromance. Kim wrote President Trump beautiful letters, beautiful letters. What happened?
Well, I think a lot of things happened. If I was going to point to one thing, and of course we don't know the North Korean thinking on this, so it's hard to explain it without being able to know more about their strategy. But I think Hanoi, the collapse in Hanoi, definitely had a negative impact on this. And I would give, you know, blame to both parties on this. The North Koreans have basically refused to engage in serious negotiation for quite some time. The U.S. Special Representative has directly and indirectly passed on messages that they're willing to meet at the working group level. They did meet in Stockholm. That did not go well at all. The U.S. had new proposals, and they just don't seem prepared to negotiate. It may be that either Kim has given up on the whole enterprise, or he thinks he can get Trump to – he may think that Trump is weak. He's going into an election. He starts off with a satellite missile launch, you know, bad but not terribly bad. And then that escalates from there to a nuclear test or even an above-ground nuclear test.
Well, how much is this – because this has always been, you know, such a complicated, almost impossible situation. And President Trump actually thought – he expressed it – that he could befriend this man. I mean, they go to the DMZ and he doesn't let John Bolton, you know, his hawk anywhere near that decision because the hawks were all up in arms over it. You know, you were not his friend.
Yeah.
Is that what we're seeing here, that, you know, President Trump completely misread the situation? And also, Kim Jong-un might feel neglected because the president's pretty busy.
Well, he's going to get a lot of attention if things go the way everyone expects them to go. I supported the president's initiative to try top-down rather than bottom-up leader-to-leader talks as a way to jumpstart a process that might lead to some outcome. And we did get freeze for freeze, which was a freeze in our military exercises and a freeze in their nuclear and long-range tests. But that was the high water mark. And I think both sides, there's reason to blame both sides in the intervening 3 years that each missed opportunities to really carry this forward with momentum.
Well, in your, you know, expert opinion, what should happen now?
Well, I hope no one overreacts. That's the number one thing. I don't think anyone will overreact. I think maybe the North Koreans are overestimating their leverage here. There's a lot going on here in the U.S., of which this is just but one issue. So I don't know how much pressure it really puts on the president. But I think, what concerns me is if you go into a crisis and you have a broken national security apparatus, right? Some people are missing from the process. Others are in acting capacity, not in full capacity. People haven't focused on this in a while. I do worry that mistakes can be made. But I don't think North Korea wants a war. I think they prefer Trump to the alternative. They think they can get a deal with him. Those are conditions that hopefully will allow us to skirt by without a mistake that leads to,
yeah.
A real problem.
Yeah. Look, just a few seconds. We saw Kim riding on a white horse up a sacred mountain.
Yes.
What do we make of that?
Well, that's the second time, though, so it's not a 100% predictor. It's that and everything else. Remember, the North Koreans have announced denuclearization is off the table. They said they're refusing to meet with anyone. They've said all this stuff. It's all pointing in the same direction.
Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What were the best albums, songs, and memorable moments from 2019? I'm Robin Hilton. Join NPR Music all this month as we look back at the past year. From Lil Nas X and Billie Eilish to Lizzo and Leonard Cohen. Listen on All Songs Considered from NPR with new episodes each week.
A young girl gets an organ lesson at the landmark Hallgrímskirkja Lutheran Church in Reykjavik, Iceland. From its 242-foot tower, you can take in a breathtaking view. Snow-capped mountains, ocean harbor, row upon row of vividly painted homes and businesses. Tourists flock here to see Iceland's unspoiled nature or bustling businesses. At dinner, our waiter won't let me tip.
No tipping in Iceland.
No tipping in Iceland. This is one of the most expensive cities in the world, so you're paying enough as it is.
Hello.
Hello.
At the Icelandic Hand Knitters Association, there are piles of Iceland's famous sweaters and hats. We're here to see firsthand the impact of the climate crisis on Iceland. For instance, tourists flying in contribute to emissions, but they buy things, boost wages, and make it expensive for locals.
I don't think they can take the price down because the salaries are high and... So it's a tricky thing. Yeah. We are a very isolated island. If people are taking this carbon footprint seriously, then they will probably stop coming. Bad for our economy, definitely. But we also see a lot of change in the weather. Last summer was the hottest summer I remember.
Reykjavik had a record.
Yeah.
And the annual Arctic report card just showed climate change ravaging the Arctic. We're standing on the Akureyri, a massive but lighter weight fishing vessel owned by Brim Fisheries, among Iceland's largest. It's nearly carbon neutral, uses geothermal and hydropower. Historically, fishing is Iceland's highest grossing industry. Now it's second to tourism, and the industry is paying attention. Producer Karen Miller-Metzen and I start a tour of their very modern Brim processing plant with supervisor Haldor Ausbjornsen.
We'll have to get dressed. We have a red hairnet. This will be a warning sign for the others, so it will help them keep you safe.
And also picture Lucy and Ethel at the chocolate factory. We'll have pictures at herenow.org.
All righty.
Okay, so we're entering the processing area where the people are filleting the fish with machines and trimming it.
And what kind of fish are we here?
Now we're doing redfish and we're doing saithe. We'll be changing over to cod soon.
But there's not as much as there once was. We walk carefully on slippery floors through this giant facility. Workers from 40 countries, whole fish sorted in giant buckets, boxes of frozen fish stacked floor to ceiling. Then a first-in-the-world technology recently debuted by Iceland's Valka company. It looks like an MRI machine with a conveyor belt, and it's sort of like a diamond cutter.
This is a water-cutting machine. In the front of the machine, we have an X-ray machine that takes pictures of the fillet, finds the bone in the fish, and we use a water jet to cut the fish.
Look at that.
Wow. Perfectly cut.
Here we have the loin, the bone piece, and then here we have the block. I can tell you, 98% of the fish and the product that comes in here, we use. Even though this piece, I dropped it on the floor.
My bad, sorry.
Yeah, don't worry. This will go for fish meal, for making food for salmon in Norway.
It's a point of pride here. Use everything and be environmentally conscious. As we leave, Haldor, a millennial with a master's in fisheries, describes changes in recent years, including the disappearance last year of the capelin. We asked whether he thinks rising sea temperatures are responsible.
It is a part of it. And I'm sorry to say, because we had, before the capelin, and we did not have the mackerel. And the mackerel is more of a warmer climate, and the mackerel came in and is exchanging the capelin, which is not necessarily good for us. Even though we have the same quota, it affects the cod, because capelin is the biggest food resource for the cod. And we saw that after the cod spawning, that it took the cod almost a month longer to get the same weight as last year when the capelin was present.
Do you fear even more changes?
I'm afraid so, yes. I'm not happy with the changes that we're having. Cod is moving more north. Plus, the spawning stations are in the south of Iceland. And that is something that we have to be worried about, that the ocean changes. We have less ice in the glaciers than we had before, and less fresh water coming in the spring. And we want this salt, icy water in the spring, because it's around the time that the cod is spawning, and it protects the roe from bacteria, because the roe doesn't want to be in 100% salty water. So I'm afraid that later on, if we lose the glaciers and we lose the fresh water that bursts with its nutrients into the ocean, that the fish stocks in Iceland might decline. Not rapidly, but it will happen gradually.
We're going to talk to your CEO about some of the changes Brim is trying to bring about to prevent that future, no cod. But how much is that important to you as a worker here?
It's really important. We do what we can. I was proud when they told us, for instance, for the vessels, that they built new vessels, but not by the regulation that is newly put in. But they looked in the future and said, okay, we want to do better vessels with less footprint than even the next regulation.
A main driver behind this thinking is Brim's CEO, Gudmundur Christensen. In his office, a wall of windows looks out on a gorgeous stone wall, deep blue sea, and snow-capped mountains. He recently received Iceland's Environmental Company of the Year award, and in accepting said that respect for nature has been our guiding principle. Sustainability results in increased profitability, and it seems to be working.
We are selling for about $250 million is our revenue. We fish 150,000 tons of fish. We have 800 people.
Not bad for leaving your village of 600 people, just a few years ago.
Well, my village is 150 and the total area was 600 people.
I know.
So I'm very proud of my village.
His father was a small boat fisherman, but Gudmundur's career rise parallels Iceland's growth in the last few decades and its move now to sustainability.
We had been overfishing our fish stocks for a long time and we had too big fleet. Now we have been reducing our fleet. We have built up our fish stocks. So we are using much less effort to fish the quantity we are allowed to fish every year.
Now you say we. Is this government imposed or?
No. We is a fishing industry. The fishing industry and the scientists and the government, we have worked very well together for the last 35 years.
And so you limited yourself?
Yes.
How else are you taking it into your own hands to do things to offset the, not the coming climate change, but the climate change that's here already?
We're building better ships. They use much less fuel than the old ships. We have lighter fishing gear. And by having better fishing stocks, we have fewer hours to fish what we need. When we come to land, we plug in electricity. And today also we plug in hot water, like in Christmas time when the boats are in for 10 days. We are heating them with hot water, but also we are using electrical cars more and more. We are studying the carbon footprint when we ship our goods to Europe or US? Shall we take it by airplane or by ship? We're doing a lot of small things.
You're drying some of the fish?
We have a fish drying company which is using geothermal heat to dry the heads of our fish, and we sell it to Africa, to Nigeria.
Your goal is to use everything.
We use everything of the fish.
Fish skin. You're using it almost like a leather?
Yes, we're using it as a leather, but also we are starting to produce collagen out of it.
Very collagen,
good.
Yeah.
Collagen, very good for your skin and your health. And also now there's a company in northwest of Iceland. They are producing bandages. So you put a cut skin on your wound and it heals very fast. They are working with the skin doctors in the U.S.
Now, you've been in the United States. You were telling us that you studied there. You were up along the East Coast in fishing towns like Gloucester or down at New Bedford, Fall River. Towns that have been decimated. Is that in your mind's eye?
Yes. I like history. I like my history teacher. He said history repeats itself. You're telling about the fishing stocks in the East Coast of U.S. It was totally overfished. You can see the buffaloes in the U.S. You totally overshoot them. In the fishing, this is the most danger that we will overexploit, overfishing. We must have a healthy stocks because then it's much cheaper to fish. And that has led in Iceland that we have many, many healthy fishing companies. They can pay their bills on the right time. And we buy technical equipment from Icelandic company who's been growing. And because they can sell technical equipment to our company, then they can sell abroad. We have a goal here, and when we pass away, the fishing stocks are in better shape than when we came. We have to be careful with nature. And that has been my goal all my life. And as a key to that, you need to have a good law, and you need to have total transparency. Transparency is a key to successful, not only fishing industry, but also utilizing national resources. The countries who don't have transparency in utilizing national resources, they are all in trouble.
So how important is fishing? Well, it's been the cause of a quarter of all wars, and Iceland's had its share. So another goal of sustainability is to maintain the peace. For pictures of our visit, wallets made of fish skin, and other stories, go to hereandnow.org.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
President Trump is addressing anti-Semitism on college campuses today by signing an executive order. It would define the Jewish people as a race or nationality, allowing the government to treat instances of anti-Semitism on college campuses as a violation of the federal civil rights law. Here to explain is Julie Zosmer of The Washington Post. And Julie, the executive order won't mean that Jewish people need to change their IDs, but explain how it would change the penalty for acts of anti-Semitism.
Right. The reason that the Trump administration is interested in doing this is a federal civil rights law called Title VI. It deals with education. If an educational institution is discriminating on the basis of race or national origin, the federal government can withhold funds from that educational institution. It does not apply to religious discrimination. So the Trump administration has been very interested in anti-Semitism on college campuses and wants to go after that. And in order to do that, they feel like they need to define Judaism to fall under race and nationality instead of falling under religion.
Okay. So under Title VI, the Department of Education has already been applying a broader definition and did so last year when investigating allegations at Rutgers University. Can you explain that case for us and how the department handled that one?
Right. A conservative Jewish organization said that the university was creating a hostile environment for Jewish students, specifically around organizing that was happening on campus that was anti-Israel organizing. Of course, there's a difference between anti-Semitism and being against the Israeli government. But in this case, the Obama administration looked at it. They closed the case without taking action. And the Trump administration came into office and the education department said, we're going to reopen this case because we think that there is a hostile environment here, not just based on what you think about policy about Israel, but a hostile environment for Jewish students. And in that case, in order to reopen it, the education department said, by the way, we consider Judaism to be a nationality. And that is what this executive order is intended to create.
And why do you think the Trump administration is taking this action?
I mean, this could clearly be done differently by an act of Congress that says something about addressing anti-Semitism specifically and about how the federal government should treat colleges that have an anti-Semitism problem in some way. Congress isn't passing that law. The Trump administration wants to fit this in with existing law without getting something passed.
Yeah, there have been some concerns about the impact this might have on free speech, and some Jewish groups are actually supporting this executive order. What have you been hearing?
Right. There's a lot of divide among Jewish groups. There are people who say, well, gosh, we'd like some protection from anti-Semitism, but this seems like really the wrong way to go about it. There are liberal Jewish groups that say this is being used as a tool to confront Palestinian activists on college campuses and that this is not for protecting Jews. There's also—
Do they have a point?
I think we have to wait and see how this does end up being applied, but they absolutely have a point that defining Judaism as a race is problematic when you look at the fact that 10% of Jews are Jews of color. American Jews are standing up and saying, my nationality is American. Almost none of the Jews in America come from Israel directly. It's a problematic definition to try to fit a religion into.
That's Julie Zosmer of The Washington Post. Thank you so much for breaking this down for us, Julie.
Thank you.
A blockbuster report this week is being compared to the Pentagon Papers, those documents that revealed the U.S. government lied to the American people about the war in Vietnam. The Washington Post reports that U.S. officials in three administrations basically did the same thing about the war in Afghanistan. Senior U.S. officials made rosy pronouncements they knew to be false, hiding unmistakable evidence as the war became unwinnable after the U.S. also invaded Iraq. The Post obtained 2,000 pages of previously unpublished notes of interviews with generals, diplomats, aid workers, Afghan officials. Jason Dempsey is a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's also a retired Army officer. He served two tours in Afghanistan. And Jason, the Post quotes one three-star general in a government interview in 2015 saying, "We didn't have the foggiest notion what we were undertaking." Your thoughts when you read this?
Well, it's both. It's great that this report is out there. You know, we need to be having these conversations. It just the unfortunate part is we're having these conversations that are too little, too late. And given that we've been talking about it for years, the question is, will this finally be enough to get us to question some fundamentals about how we're approaching Afghanistan?
Well, and when you think that, you know, 2,400 or so U.S. troops died, their blood was shed on this ground. And, you know, we're reading that many of them, at the time when they were there, questioned their directions. How about you?
Yes and no. I would say, and the interesting thing about the design of this war and where the military shares a large degree of culpability is in the way we rotated people through, such that the majority of people who went there were going there for the first time. And they went there with all the optimism and drive that you would expect of American service members. Unfortunately, that optimism and drive extrapolated over only something of maybe a 4, 9, or 12-month deployment means that everybody could leave at the end of their individual tour and pat themselves on the back and say, yep, I made progress, without considering whether or not what they did actually added up to anything that was sustainable or contributed to a meaningful long-term goal for the stability of Afghanistan. To your question, you know, for me, it was really – it was being there in 2009, sharing all that optimism just as the Obama administration was pouring troops in, thinking that we were all finally getting to the good war, but then turning around, in my case, going back in 12 and 13 and realizing that we were essentially on a treadmill, that very little progress was being made, and that every single rotation was repeating the efforts of the rotations prior.
Yeah. Well, there is such a thing as the fog of war. I mean, this is these aren't video games. You know, these are complex societies. But still, you wrote this in February of this year, the U.S. failed in Afghanistan. The only points of debate left for analysts and historians are by how much and who is to blame. Now, the report, though, seems to conclude that the war effort was going well in Afghanistan, the effort to take down the Taliban, which had given comfort to Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 attackers. But then in 2003, the George W. Bush administration invaded Iraq based on false information about weapons of mass destruction, a country that was run by a tyrant, yes, but it had nothing to do with 9/11, was a relatively stable country. And the report seems to conclude, or you know, people in the report seem to conclude that that's when Afghanistan went off track. Do you think blame can start there?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, this is a case where everybody shares a little bit of the blame. And we certainly took our eye off the ball. But there was also, even had we been there and stayed there, I don't think we could have overcome some of that fundamental American arrogance and ignorance with the way we were approaching foreign countries. Because you remember, it went so fast that we took down the Taliban. And then, you know, around all the hoopla over the Loya Jirga and we were going to draft a new constitution for Afghanistan, I think we fell into that quintessential American trap of believing that because we have unchallenged military might, that that can translate into the ability to turn foreign countries into miniature versions of ourselves.
Mm. And by the way, you say the Loya Jirga, that's the tribal council. President Trump made a surprise visit to Afghanistan on Thanksgiving, announcing that peace talks with the Taliban had resumed. He had canceled them earlier this fall after the Taliban had made attacks and also a U.S. soldier was killed. Here's the president speaking at Bagram Airfield on Thanksgiving.
The Taliban wants to make a deal. We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see. But they want to make a deal. And they only want to make a deal because you're doing a great job. That's the only reason they want to make a deal.
And absolutely no disrespect to the people he's talking to, the service members who have no fault here at all. But you're I hear you chuckling.
Yeah, I mean, this was in keeping with this commander in chief who has failed in almost every respect to be a commander in chief. The statement caught everybody by surprise, including apparently the Taliban, including his negotiators, including the Joint Chiefs. It was something that he made up on the fly. And I guess it's the perfect encapsulation of the absurdity of this in that reality be damned in Afghanistan. We're just going to wish that it could turn out the way we want it to.
Yeah. Well, you are being very critical of President Trump, but this report is critical of President Obama before him and President Bush. It feels as if every administration just could not wrap their arms around this. And the Washington Post first came out with these documents, but the New York Times has set them in a graph, and it's stunning. $2 trillion was spent in Afghanistan, $1.5 trillion waging war, and the Taliban now control or contest much of the country, $87 billion to train Afghan military and police. Afghan forces can't support themselves. $10 billion on counter-narcotics. Afghanistan supplies 80% of the world's heroin. I mean, it just goes on and on. $24 billion on economic development. Most Afghans still live in poverty. Again, given the treasure that was lost there.
There's plenty of blame to go around. And unfortunately, what we've allowed, we're stuck, unfortunately, in this weird situation where we've got this toxic and somewhat dysfunctional blend of both fear on the one hand and indifference on the other, right? What keeps us there, a colleague of mine this morning who was a veteran himself who also worked in the Obama administration, Andrew Exum, said the reason we're still there is because everybody's afraid of what theoretically might happen if we were to leave. Now, nobody can quantify that. Nobody can say why Afghanistan is more of a threat than any other terrorist safe haven on Earth. But we're still – we're not going to pull out because nobody wants an attack to come from there. Yet we also don't care enough to really dig in and say, well, are the actions we're taking, are they actually making a sustainable difference? And this is where every single metric you pointed out is absolutely true, and almost all the metrics point to failure. Yet the way we've run this war is that somebody like Nicholson, former commander in Afghanistan, he can say, hey, look, now we're taking on the opium trade. And he can show you short-term metrics of, you know, blowing up factories or taking opium out of the countryside. But yet, as we all know, our opium policy has changed year by year by year. And so who cares if tactically we made a short or small dent in the opium trade over 6 months? We have not had a coherent strategy to deal with the opium trade writ large. And so overall, it's largely been a failure. And that applies to almost every dimension of our effort in Afghanistan.
Well, briefly, what would you do?
So for one, we have to realize that we are not going to create an Afghanistan that looks like America. And unfortunately, what we've been building is a military that looks like ours. We need to cut that out and let Afghanistan figure out its own direction, its own path. And that's going to be a little bit messy. And we have to have some faith in the fact that people actually want peace besides us. And so we should let them figure it out versus trying to impose our solution on Afghanistan.
Does that mean U.S. troops stay there to kind of keep safety on the sidelines while this happens?
I don't think so, because whenever troops are there, we're inevitably drawn into fighting or checking the various groups. And until a peace deal is reached with the Taliban, any U.S. troops that are there will find themselves in a constant tension of fighting the Taliban. And at the end of the day, as you mentioned before, they weren't our original enemy. They don't need to be our enemy now.
Jason Dempsey, retired Army officer who served in Afghanistan, now a senior fellow at the Center for the New American Security, also a non-resident fellow with the newly established Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Jason, I'm going to ask our other listeners who also served in Afghanistan to please weigh in, see what other opinions that we get. But thank you so much for yours and your service.
Thank you for your time.
We're about to have a conversation about sexual assault that may be sensitive for some listeners. The song you just heard is the feminist anthem Un Violador en Tu Camino, A Rapist in Your Path, and it's making its way around the world. It first began in Chile, created by the Chilean artistic collective Las Tesis to highlight gender violence in the country, where it's been reported that there are 42 cases of sexual violence reported to police each day. There have now been spontaneous performances of this song in Mexico, Venezuela, France, Spain, India, the UK, and now here in the United States, where it's inspired many women to hold demonstrations, including Valu Ochoa, who is organizing a performance this Sunday in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Valu.
Thank you.
This song is really powerful. It starts with an electric beat, the women singing in unison wearing blindfolds, and one of the most striking lyrics is, quote, "And the fault wasn't mine, not where I was, not how I dressed. The rapist is you." Why does this song resonate so deeply with you?
It reminded me of the many times that I have felt violated and that I have felt assaulted. And it was very emotional. I just went through, it was like an electricity going through my body. And then magically the next day, a friend of mine reached out to me, a friend of mine who owns a theater company here in Washington, D.C. called Teatro La Bolsa. She reached out to me and invited me to join. And we basically now are about 8 people in the organizing committee. So it's a combination of Chileans and Colombians.
Yes, it's a collective.
Yeah, it is a collective. So we decided to make it a collective. It's called Purple Movement, Movimiento Púrpura, and it's in a mission to basically make awareness of gender violence and call for a stop.
When you perform it in D.C. this weekend, does it take on more or different meanings for you and gender violence here in the United States?
the message, like I said, it's pretty much the same. I feel like we, as women, we are always, considered at fault when it comes to someone abusing us or assaulting us. So what Las Tesis did was basically providing a platform of expression through a song that summarizes basically the feeling and the experience that every one of us goes through since childhood. So some of us, one of the girls that are part of the organizing group, are Chilean. So we're still trying to maintain the message of Chile, but we're also trying to translate that into a more international message. Which is why we translated also the lyrics, and we are performing in both Spanish and English.
Yes. I mean, it's not only a song. It really is a political mobilization. What do you want to come of this song?
I'm pretty sure we all want to be heard. We want to be listened. We want to show that we care even though we have not been violated. You know, I mean, I think there's been a lot of criticism in terms of saying that, some of us are crying wolf, but it's not that. It's that we are basically together. We are women, ultimately, beyond being born in a different country, beyond having a different political view. We are all women, and we all feel the same pain. And we all have had a cousin or a sister or a mother that has been abused. We are the 50% of the population. So if we want society to really work, we need to make a statement and need to start making some changes and need to be considered as equals.
Valu, I think what strikes so many of us who are watching this is that it feels spontaneous, that there's something about art and theater working in this way to spread a message that is very important. It's gone through country to country, and now it's here in the United States.
What I can tell you from here in Washington, D.C. is that it was like a big wave of women coming in and wanting to participate. We didn't really, it wasn't like a big effort. We didn't have to do any paper motion. It was just word of mouth, and women just flocked to us and started asking us how they can participate and volunteer. And so, yeah, I mean, it's people that haven't met. We just created a group on Facebook, and it started getting bigger and bigger. And now we are mm-hmm. over 300 people in the group. And we just mm-hmm. started talking about planning this event 2 weeks ago. And that really means something, you know. It does mean that this is real. This is truth, and this is happening to a lot of us.
That's Valu Ochoa, who is organizing a performance this Sunday in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial. Thank you so much, Valu, for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya, for having me.
El Estado! El Presidente!
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
El